Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
By the closing bell this afternoon, Goldman Sachs was worth $10 billion less than it had been when the day started. You can credit a fairly significant whiff of scandal at the granddaddy of Wall Street investment banks for that one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering GoToMyPC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture and creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. More at producemoreconservemore.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the 16th of April. Glad to have you with us. And this was quite a day in the evolution of the financial crisis we've all come to know so well. The Securities and Exchange Commission has filed its first big crisis-related lawsuit. And rather than start small, the SEC is going after the biggest fish it can, Goldman Sachs. The SEC says Goldman and one of its vice presidents let a big hedge fund stack the deck on some investments that were based on mortgages that were about to go bad. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the story.
The Goldman Sachs VP at the center of the alleged fraud was Fabrice Touré. The SEC says he let the hedge fund Paulson & Company influence the structure of an investment called a synthetic collateralized debt obligation. Karen Petru of Federal Financial Analytics says it's one of the most complicated investments out there.
I think you need to be at a cocktail party to think you understand collateralized debt obligations, or CDOs.
At its heart, though, a synthetic CDO is simply a pool of mortgages. Paulson saw many of these mortgages were subprime, or pretty dicey, and yet the bonds based on them were still being given the gold seal of approval by rating agencies. Paulson selected the investments it thought were most likely to go bad. It asked Touré to fill up one of those synthetic CDOs with them, and then Goldman sold those mortgage-backed bonds to its clients. Cornelius Hurley of Boston University Law School picks up the story.
Paulson all the time was betting against the success of those investments. All the while, Goldman was not revealing to its investing clients that it was on both sides of that deal.
In other words, Goldman's employee knew Paulson was betting against the mortgage bonds, but he sold them on to other investors without saying a word. The SEC says that's fraud. Goldman might say investment banks always do this kind of thing. They sell investments to clients and also hedge against them to spread their risk. Petru won't buy that argument, though.
An embedded conflict of interest that creates risk for investors is a material fact that should have been disclosed.
Hedge fund manager John Paulson is not charged in this suit, although he made billions when the investments he'd bet against went bad. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As it happens, this is earnings season on Wall Street. J.P. Morgan Chase announced first quarter profits Wednesday, and today Bank of America did the same. After losing money for two consecutive quarters, B of A earned $3.2 billion over the past 3 months. They did it not so much with actual banking as with trading. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains what that is and why it matters.
B of A's commercial side is still having a hard time. The home mortgage business keeps losing money, and the bank is still writing off credit card loans, although fewer than it was. But trading revenue grew to $7 billion. Anthony Polini is an analyst at Raymond James.
You know, why do trading profits go up at any given time? It's a function of more client activity and usually more volatility.
The trading business also tends to do better during the first quarter of the year. B of A has been focusing more attention on trading since it bought Merrill Lynch last year, but its real strength has always been on the commercial side, business and consumer loans and banking. Jefferson Harrelson follows the bank for Keith Briette and Woods, and he says B of A is not going to suddenly shift away from that focus.
The trading is sort of a good that it's been strong, and it's sort of a placeholder until the rest of the bank reaches their normalized earnings.
The big question for B of A is when its commercial business will start to pick up again. Joe Morford's an analyst at RBC Capital Markets. He says there's not a lot of demand for loans right now, so getting the commercial side to grow is largely out of the bank's control.
You know, a lot of it will be tied to the strength of the broader economy. So the business is realistically likely to be, you know, fairly sluggish here in the near term.
Morford and other analysts say it'll probably be a few more quarters before the commercial side really picks up. Until then, B of A will just have to hope the trading business can keep the profits coming in. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in the land of never-ending fallout, that volcano in Iceland hasn't quite given up yet. Bad news for the hundreds of thousands of passengers who are still stranded on both sides of the Atlantic. Latest word is delays could last well into next week. But it's not just passengers who are stuck in a holding pattern. The business of aviation is causing its own delays. United Airlines and Continental are said to be in merger talks, which might back things up a bit in Cleveland, Ohio. Brett Neely has more.
Cleveland is home to Continental's third biggest hub after Houston and Newark. But if the merger goes through, Cleveland's future may not be so bright. Ned Hill is the dean of Cleveland State University's College of Urban Affairs.
Corporate headquarters are a very important part of the economic base of this region. And it's not the Fortune 500 headquarters. It really is its closely held companies, its branches of bigger companies.
If the hub closes, he said it may be hard to retain some of those companies and to attract new ones.
Because business people don't want to change planes.
Hubs are expensive for airlines to maintain. That's why St. Louis, Pittsburgh, and Cincinnati all lost theirs after big airline mergers. Now, people flying in and out often have to take smaller regional jets to a bigger city and then change planes. Bob Mann is an aviation consultant. He says airlines prefer to focus on richer cities that have the money to upgrade terminals and runways.
Markets and hubs get the level of service that they're willing to pay for.
There is one silver lining to losing the hub status, says Alan Michael at Boston University. A major airline tends to dominate traffic at a hub. Now, there might be plenty of gates for low-cost airlines.
It's certainly conceivable that if it's no longer a hub, their fares may drop.
But Cleveland State's Ned Hill says as an economist, he sees a dark cloud in every silver lining.
To the average Clevelander, great, we can have a cheaper ticket to Orlando, but I may not have a job to pay for the ticket.
Until the merger is official, Hill doesn't plan to give up his Continental frequent flyer card. I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, yeah, not so good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. On a scale of 1 to 10, how productive do you think your boss is? What about the integrity of the guy who sits next to you? 1, 2, 10? They don't necessarily have to be hypothetical questions, you know. A new website called GetUnvarnished.com lets you rate your coworkers 1 to 10 anonymously in categories like productivity and relationships, and then they get rolled into star ratings, 1 star to 5 stars. We called co-founder Pete Kazanji to run us through this thing. Pete, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kai.
All right, so explain it to me. How does Unvarnished work?
So essentially what Unvarnished is trying to do is take how professional reputation works in the offline world and bring it online. Right now, professional reputation information kind of it exists in the minds of all of our colleagues, and that information is very kind of fractured and not accessible. And what we're seeking to do is surface that information in such a way that it makes it much more accessible and much more valuable, much the same way that websites like TripAdvisor has done for hotels and Yelp has done for restaurants and dentists and doctors and plumbers and individuals as well.
And all of those things I get, right? Hotels and travel experiences and even dentists. But somehow this idea of professional reputation being open to such interpretation, it's a tricky thing, isn't it?
Well, I think it is, but I think that a lot of times people say they immediately go to thinking about themselves being reviewed as opposed to, wow, it would be great for a forum where I can express my opinion and give, you know, great credit where credit is due and also feedback where needed. And also great to have a resource where I could actually get the inside scoop and figure out, you know, who's great to work with, who's good to work with, and who maybe I want to avoid.
All right. So here's what we did. We set up an account for me on your website. And in all honesty, I did pretty well. I got a whole bunch of 5-star reviews, which is very nice. I got some 6s in relationships, which frankly is a little bit troubling, but I guess we'll work on that. But basically, people said, oh, yeah, hardworking, smart, this and that. And here's the thing. I'm just not that great a guy.
Well, I think the mechanism that you're seeing right there is part of how Unvarnished works. So we do obscure the reviewer's name in order to allow them to be candid and nuanced. And I think you actually saw that, Kai, because there were a lot of plaudits there, but also there was some of the commentary was that, you know, Kai is a no-nonsense kind of guy, and if you try to snow him, he's going to drill down on you. And I think that sort of information would be really valuable to, like, a would-be producer who's looking to work with you, or even maybe a radio guest.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I'm pulling yours up here. You actually got a 3-star there, dude. Did you know that?
I did know that, but the 3-star ones, they don't have text with them.
Right,
if you
right,
went
right.
To...
It was the uncommented 3-star, which has to be painful.
Yeah, uncommented, but I think that what's more interesting is if you click through some of the pages there, I do actually have a 2-star review, but I was able to respond to it, right? And the community has downvoted that vote, saying that they don't agree with that. And of course, I've been able to request more reviews to kind of tell my side of the story.
That brings up the Yelp question, though. Yelp, this site where consumers can rate and review consumer items in stores and restaurants and all that stuff. And a lot of the stores and commercial establishments that were getting rated were getting skewered by people who, you know, those commercial establishments said had some kind of axe to grind.
The way that we approach the safeguards associated with this, because there need to be a lot of safeguards here, is kind of a layered approach where, you know, first and foremost, you can't get on the site unless you've been invited by somebody by having them request a review from you. That makes it very challenging for somebody to just spin up a new account in order to say nasty things about Kai. But then, yes, we do have community flagging. We do manually review all the content as it comes onto the site right now to make sure that it's business focused. Mm-hmm. So there is accountability on the site in that capacity.
Pete Cassandri, he's the co-founder of GetUnvarnished.com. He's got a 5-star rating, by the way, 9s out of 10s on all his things. I've only got like 6s and 7s, but that's all right. Pete, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for having me.
I could take the next 30 seconds or so to set up our weekly wrap, tell you how this happened or that happened, but really, two words ought to about do it. Wall and street. Lee Gallagher's here from Fortune Magazine, also Megan McArdle from The Atlantic. It's good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so Goldman Sachs is maybe the biggest of big names on Wall Street. Either of you guys surprised that it turns out they were up to some hanky-panky?
Well, it's not surprising to me in one sense, which is that Goldman Sachs now has a big, fat target on it. Yeah. Between all of the bad publicity they've gotten and the fact that they, of all the other banks, have probably emerged in the best position and certainly the most highly publicized position out of the entire crisis, you can bet that there were a lot of prosecutors and people at the SEC who wanted to take them down. You know, there's always this flood when these allegations come out. They always look as bad as possible because mm-hmm. you haven't heard any of the defense side yet. And so we've seen investigations like the case against the two hedge fund managers at Bear Stearns, where the initial complaint just looked horrific. But then when the defense had mounted their case, it was less clear that anything bad had been done.
Yeah, those Bear Stearns hedge fund managers, we should mention, got off. I mean, they're not doing any time or anything.
Because it turned out that the quotes that sounded the worst in the complaint turned out to have been taken out of context, out of emails, where if you read the whole email, they sounded very, very different.
Right. Lee, Megan mentioned a target on Goldman's back. Does this damage its market position in any way? Does it hurt what it does for a living?
I think there's a good chance that it won't, if this ends up being more just the SEC showing teeth. We just don't know yet. And I'll agree with Megan. I mean, when I first saw the headline, Goldman, SEC investigating, my instinct was, oh, this is just the SEC trying desperately to show that they are fierce now. After
doing
missing,
something, right?
Yeah, exactly. After missing Madoff and lots of other things. But this is certainly the most severe allegation that's come out against them. And it also shows that throughout this whole financial crisis, everybody's been saying, oh, we didn't know it was this bad. We didn't know it was this bad. And greed is not illegal. But just in the past couple of weeks, we're getting to things that might have been illegal. I mean, things like this and things like Lehman with...
Exactly. This whole Hudson Castle thing that we talked about on the program on Tuesday, which brings a bigger point to the table, Megan, which is everybody was doing this.
I think it's been clear even before the financial crisis that the big banks have basically everything stacked in their favor. The question is it criminal? I mean, if you read Michael Lewis's The Big Short, for example, mm-hmm. you read descriptions of the people who bought CDSs from them, who wanted to bet against the housing market. Somehow those CDSs were always repriced in favor of Goldman. They were never repriced in favor of the person who held them until everything blew up and they had to pay off. We've known for a long time that there's been this kind of taking advantage of their position at the apex of a not very transparent set of markets. But I think we still have yet to see whether these things are actually going to have crossed the line into outright criminality, or whether we're just going to be kind of left saying, we don't like this, we don't want it to happen, but how do we make a rule against it?
Well, interesting you should bring that up, because the president said today, you know, I'm not going to sign anything that doesn't control derivatives if Congress sends me a financial reform bill. And all 41 Republicans in the Senate today said they're opposed to the current bill. Does the news of this week, Lee, change the political dynamic about new regulations for Wall Street?
I think it has to. And, you know, Republicans are in a tough spot because nobody wants to be siding with the banks. The banks are toxic. I think the people now that have the biggest case to push for less reform are the banks, and they just lost a lot of credibility.
Megan, what do you think?
I've never really understood why the Republicans had chosen this particular hill to die on. It doesn't seem like this is actually particularly well in line with what they say or their values. I mean, there really are some people who don't want any money at all to ever go to banks in the future. But given that that's not very practical, I don't understand what the unified opposition to this bill is. And I think that this is going to make it a lot harder to stick that out. The more news that comes out, the angrier people get with these banks. And eventually, you're going to have to be able to say something has been done.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, Megan McArdle from The Atlantic. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
Coming up, yes, you too can make money off YouTube.
We've made in excess of $100,000, significantly over that, you know, low six figures.
Oh, wait, there's a catch. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slid 0.1% today, 125 points, 11,018. The NASDAQ ditched 1.3%, 34 points, finished at 2,481. The S&P 500 fumbled 1.6%, 19 points, ended at 1,192. For the week, though, the Dow gained 0.2%. The NASDAQ rose 1.1%. The S&P 500 shaved off 0.2%. Goldman Sachs dropped more than 12% on the news of that SEC lawsuit, pulled the rest of the banking sector down with it, of course. Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, and Citigroup each fell roughly 5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-notes fell to 3.77%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com. By T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
State Book, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. People gather at the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum in honor of the 168 people killed 15 years ago in the Oklahoma City bombing. And remember that Rolling Stone article from, oh, say, 1967? You can find the magazine's back issues online, but you'll have to pay for full access. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The National Basketball Association playoffs start tomorrow. Fans, of course, are going to be most interested in final scores, who wins and who loses. More detailed, you might say, observers are going to want to delve more deeply into other statistics, but commentator and our former colleague Kevin Arnovitz says that has its downsides.
About 18 months ago, I left Marketplace to cover the NBA for ESPN.com, and it seemed like a radical move at the time. Behavioral economics, credit default swaps, and commercial paper have given way to the three-pointer, the block shot, and late-game heroics. Only that's not exactly how it's played out. Turns out the NBA is like every other global enterprise these days. Analytics are taking over. Many of the age-old assumptions we have about pro basketball simply don't stand up to the empirical data. For instance, average points per game has long been the gold standard when approximating players' value, but that stat is now being replaced by smarter metrics that measure a scorer's efficiency. Forward-looking teams have hired MBAs and statistical analysts to answer questions about the game that seemed like riddles just a few years ago. And these early adapters, they're winning far more basketball games than the teams who have yet to hop on board. As someone who writes about this trend, I've immersed myself in the NBA's analytics movement. I spent a ton of time filtering these new stats. And the reality that the unknowable has become knowable has started to affect my everyday life in some really weird ways. Like, I can't go to the grocery store anymore without measuring how much time the presence of a bagger can shave off the checkout process. I always felt it was negligible, but now I'm worried I was wrong all along. Or my Saturday morning tennis game. My opponent often charges the net. Should I hire a kid to chart whether I'm better off going with a lob or a passing shot? Or the value of waiting to make a left turn with no arrow into my neighborhood versus going a block out of the way to avoid the backup altogether? I've started to rank friends on a punctuality index. The list is inexhaustible and exhausting. But the tantalizing fact that almost everything in life can be quantified, basketball, traffic, even friendship, is irresistible.
Kevin Arnovitz covers the National Basketball Association for ESPN.com. He's also the managing editor of the True Hoop Network. You can send us your thoughts, whether you like basketball or not. We don't care. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Marketplace is, of course, a serious news operation. But we who work here are not immune to those emails. The ones where a friend sends you a link to a YouTube video of a parrot riding a kitten like a pony. We click. We watch. The difference is that when we business news gatherers notice a video has been viewed millions of times, we say, man, how much do you suppose that's worth? Here's Marketplace's Rico Galliano.
2 years ago, David DeVore was a humble stay-at-home dad. Today?
I am running a business based on my son's viral video, David After Dentist.
He's laughing because, at first glance, the video's not something you'd think could sustain a business. DeVore used a simple flip cam to film his 7-year-old son, David, right after the kid got a tooth removed. The dentist's drugs had not fully worn off.
Is this real life?
Yeah, this is real life.
The clip is funny, kind of sweet, and it's been watched more than 55 million times. DeVore says there's a good chance this 2-minute video will end up paying for David Jr.'s college education.
We've made in excess of $100,000 significantly over that, you know, low six figures.
So where did that money come from? Well, there is predictably merchandising. The punky fashion store Hot Topic sells Is This Real Life t-shirts. The DeVores get a cut of those sales and sell their own t-shirt design online.
Something that's a little bit more marketable to everybody, because the Hot Topic shirt was purple, so I won't even wear that one.
There's also licensing money from, for instance, the TV manufacturer Vizio. The company paid to use a snippet of David After Dentist in its Super Bowl commercial.
Is this real life?
But most of DeVore's revenues come from YouTube itself, and he's not the only one making a regular income from the site.
Some of the more popular users at YouTube apply to be partners.
That's YouTube spokesperson Aaron Zamost. He says partners range from big movie studios to individual users like DeVore who strike advertising deals with the site. YouTube gets permission to sell ad space next to or during the user's videos.
And then we share with them the revenue generated as a result. And in all instances, we give these users, who now become partners, the majority of the money.
Sweet, right? But before you make plans to pay your mortgage by posting videos, consider. YouTube has accepted only around 10,000 partners. And to become number 10,001, it may not be enough to have a video millions of people have seen. It still has to be deemed worthy by algorithms, which put a premium on how fast a video lures viewers.
Let's imagine a video has 10 million views on YouTube already, and it gets another 100,000 views. That's a lot, but it's not a humongous increase. Imagine a video has 5,000 views and gets 100,000 additional views. That's a real acceleration in view count. So our algorithms don't really look at just raw views.
Ultimately, only a few hundred individual users manage to make big money as partners, as in thousands of dollars a month. And then there's the one in a million user who hits a bigger jackpot.
Hey, it's Fred, and it's Father's Day. I've never seen my dad before, and I think I'm going to write him a letter.
Do not adjust your radio. The voice you're hearing is purposely that annoying. It's a character named Fred, the creation of 16-year-old Lucas Cruikshank. His homemade Fred videos have generated almost half a billion views on YouTube. And this summer, cable channel Nickelodeon will premiere Fred the Movie. Its producer, Brian Robbins, says Cruikshank will share the revenues from the franchise, which includes a sequel already in the works. That could be a huge sum, if the young viewers who make every Fred video a YouTube hit show up for the movies.
Well, that's the billion-dollar question, right? Do people who watch something on YouTube, will it translate to regular media?
If the answer is yes, expect more producers trawling YouTube for the next Hollywood hit, and more living room auteurs looking to be among the very few to cash in. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A slightly unconventional final note on the way out today. Marketplace is, as you hear on the air from time to time, including today, sponsored by the biotechnology firm Monsanto. It's an unpopular arrangement with some of you. This past Tuesday, we aired a story about genetically modified crops without openly acknowledging that support from Monsanto. That is, letting you know that we know that they advertise with us. I will tell you that more than the usual number of complaints were had, so here's the question. Forget Monsanto for just a second and tell us when you think we should do those acknowledgments, whatever the company is. Or do we really have to do them at all? I mean, you don't see newspapers or magazines or television newscasts doing it when they cover an advertiser, even when it's Monsanto, which is also buying ad space in, just for instance, the New York Times. Do you think it's different for us because we're a business show or because we're public radio, maybe? We're going to put something together for air next week about the feedback we get. We want to start that conversation with you online, so go to our website. It's marketplace.org. There's a place you can check in right there. And on a Friday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 125 points after Goldman Sachs. That's 1.1%. The NASDAQ dipped 34 points. That's about 1/3 of 1%. The S&P 500 lost 19 points, 1.2%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is a guy named J.J. Yule. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, financial justice on television.
We've made in excess of $100,000 significantly over that, you know, low six figures.
It's the creators of the TV series Damages. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will be back here on Monday, same time, same channel. See you then.
American Public Media.